Welcome to the REI Mastermind Network, where host Jack Haas gathers amazing stories from leaders in real estate investing. In each episode, our guests will tell you what they're doing that works, what they've tried that failed, and best of all, you'll learn actionable steps to take your real estate investing to the next level. Now, here's Jack with another value-packed episode.
Dave Foster joins me here today, and you better stick around because we're going to go all in regarding 1031 exchanges. And I know this is a really exciting topic, but it's a very important one as you're maturing in your real estate investing journey. So Dave, I really appreciate your time here today. You can learn what his team is up to by going to the1031investor.com.
So good to be here. I don't know that I've ever heard real estate tax law and exciting used in the same sentence. So kudos to you.
When you're this level of nerd that listens to this show, it is exciting. So
that's exactly who I am. I'm a nerd that loves to live in that, primarily though, because of the impact that 1031 exchanges had in my life and what I see in the lives of others.
So I hate to start at the beginning of this, but, and we're not going to spend a ton of time on your background because I think everybody can learn that by just heading to your website. I kind of want to get into the meat of this, but what I'm going to make you have to do is kind of give us kind of a summary of what a 1031 exchange is and where it applies to people's lives in our scenarios.
Yeah, absolutely.
Start at the beginning.
So the 1031 exchange, it's like 100-year old part of the IRS code. And it exists to encourage a vibrant real estate industry. The IRS wants real estate transactions to happen. And an old mentor of mine once said, stop thinking about the IRS code as being a way for them to get your taxes. Start thinking of it as an incentivizer of behavior. And that's what the 1031 exchange is, because it allows you to sell investment real estate that's either highly appreciated or has been highly depreciated. And by using the process of a 1031 exchange, you can then buy new investment real estate and indefinitely defer paying tax on the profits that you normally would have. And I use the word indefinitely very deliberately. And my journey really comes out of a single real estate mistake that haunts me to this day. My very first property that I purchased way back 30 years ago, I did not do a 1031 exchange on it because I didn't know about it. And I sold the property and I thought I was in Fat City. To my accountant said, man, you got a $30,000 tax bill. I said, wait a minute, how can that be? Oh, it's my silent partner, Uncle Sam. Thank you very much. And that $30,000 went in taxes. And immediately after that, I found 1031 exchanges. And if I would have done a 1031 exchange and kept that $30,000 working for me for 30 years, compounded at, say, 10%, every 7 years that would have doubled. It's pretty easy to do the math and say that I lost out on a bunch of money by not doing the 1031 exchange. But that's the real value of it, is that it allows you to take tax and instead invest that for your benefit simply by doing what you normally do, sell investment real estate, buy new investment real estate.
Yeah. Could you kind of give us the breakdown and kind of the workflow of how this all happens? Because I know that there are some time limitations and everything associated with this, and you kind of need to identify the new property within a certain amount of time. And there's some in and outs that people need to be aware of.
Yeah, the devil's in the details, of course, and the IRS is never going to make it easy, right, for you to understand it. So the very first and most important rule is that you cannot do these yourselves. There has to be a person called the qualified intermediary, who's an unrelated third party to everything else. Your realtor can't be your QI, your attorney, your accountant, the title company. None of them can be your QI. It's got to be an unrelated third party. And that QI documents the 1031 exchange on the sale of the old property. They hold your proceeds because the IRS does not let you touch them in between. And then they also document the 1031 exchange on your purchase and send the money out for your purchase. So for you, Jack, you really don't do anything different. It's this QI who's managing a process inside your normal activity of buying and selling. But those details that you're talking about, you use the QI. The QI has to be present prior to the closing of your sale. You have 45 days after that to find and identify your potential replacements, total of 180 days to close. It's got to be investment real estate, but it can be investment real estate of any type. And the title or the taxpayer for the property has to remain consistent from the old to the new property. And then lastly, probably most misunderstood, is that if you want to defer all tax, you have to purchase at least as much as your net sale, and you have to use all of your net proceeds in order to do that. So for you, it's a perception of, I'm not just reinvesting the profit, I'm reinvesting the profit and my original capital. Because if you take money out, the IRS says you're taking profit out. And that's, they make the rules, so they win the argument. But that's, those six requirements really make up about, for us, two sentences, but 8,000 pages of case law. And that's what the qualified intermediary is there for, to make sure and be your guide through that whole process for a successful 1031.
One of the things that I think is really important there that you just pointed out is the 45 days to identify. That doesn't mean we have to be closing. We just have to identify a property and then 180 days to close. What happens if something falls apart? Like we have an interruption in this closing process.
Sure. Well, first of all, there's no penalty for starting and not completing an exchange. So if something falls apart, if you can't find good properties to replace it with, let your exchange die. You'll pay the same tax you would have at the same time you would have. But starting the 1031 exchange, initiating that 45-day period is what lets you, gives you the flexibility to kick the can down the road. Now, if you're still within your 45-day period, simply identify more properties because the list does not go hard until midnight on day 45. And as a matter of fact, we see probably as many people as not these days who will already be under contract for their new property before their old property closes. And that's perfectly fine. Now, you see how that would help mitigate your risk, right? But what it also does is it condenses the amount of time so that you're spending less time without cash flow. And it's helping you mitigate risk. But in any event, you've got 45 days. And if you're past day 45, you can't make changes to that list. You're stuck with what's on it. And I literally just got done with an exchange a couple months ago with a client who lost every one of his properties on his list. They were all raw land, and he got outbid for all of them because he was using too sharp of a pencil. But that was his list. He had to go to every buyer that had outbid him, and he offered them all $5,000 to $10,000 just for the right for him to go back and buy the property he got outbid for. Because those were his only choices. That was a brutal day.
Did it work out?
It did, actually. He got every one of his properties. And so he still deferred way more tax than he would have. But it was just pretty painful and stressful.
So you mentioned a list. When you're talking about a list, are you referring to you can identify more than one property and then acquire one of them? Or are you talking about a list of like acquiring a portfolio?
No, it works both ways. You could certainly acquire a portfolio of, say, 10 properties, and that could be one of the properties on your list. A portfolio can act as one identification. But when it becomes one identification, you must purchase every property on that portfolio. So it's the portfolio that you have to purchase. But what most people refer to with this list is that it's simply a documented writing that is turned into us, by day 45 that identifies your potential replacement properties. You don't have to purchase every one of them. But every property you purchase has to be on that list. Mm-hmm. Now, we're about to get into the deep weeds, but we'll go there for a couple minutes because there's some nuance to this list. If you name three or fewer properties on it, it doesn't matter what they're worth. So you could sell a property for $100,000 and put three $5 million properties on your list. That's perfectly fine. But if you want to name four or more properties, then their total value either cannot exceed 200% of what you sold, or you have to purchase every one of them. So again, you sell for $100,000. You could name three $5 million properties. Doesn't matter. You could name four $50,000 properties because that's a total list of 200,000 and that's no more than 200% of what you sold.
Mm-hmm.
But if you tried to name, say, three $50,000 properties and one $75,000 property, your only option then is you have to purchase every one of the properties. So what the IRS is doing is creating a funnel because they want to control information. They're not directly controlling how many properties you purchase, but indirectly they are, aren't they?
Mm-hmm. Well, this is one of those gotchas that I try to dig out of here. Is there any more that somebody should be aware of before they get into this? Any more rules?
Well, there's all sorts of opportunities rather than gotchas. For instance, with the taxpayer requirement, if you're on the deed to a piece of property personally, you have to go on title to the new property personally because the IRS is concerned that the new property be reported on the same tax return as the old property. But so many people, particularly if they're moving from single family residential to multifamily or commercial, will want to take title to their new properties as LLCs for liability issues. And there's actually a way to do that because a single member LLC that has filed an election to be taxed as a sole proprietor does not file its own tax return. All the activity of the property is still on your personal tax return. So it's called a disregarded entity. So you could sell as yourself and you could buy as a disregarded LLC. And that's perfectly fine. So it's not so much a gotcha, but it's an opportunity to work within the law to put yourself into a better position. The reinvestment requirements. It could be one property you purchase, but it also could be multiple cheaper properties that total up to that amount. So there's just all sorts of different ways. And that's what the QI is there for, to look at your personal situation and see where you want to get to and craft the 1031 so that it goes from where you're at to where you want to get to.
Yeah, this has been a really interesting conversation so far, Dave, and I appreciate you getting to the weeds with us. Just to remind everybody, if you want to learn what Dave's team can help you with regarding a 1031 exchange, head over to the 1031investor.com, and I'm going to make sure that that is a clickable link in the show notes. I'm sure there's a lot of great resources there. If you found some value in what we're talking about so far here today, do us a quick favor and share it with one of your investor friends. And if you're watching this on YouTube, as always, we ask for a quick thumbs up and a subscribe. So, Dave, I'm curious now. You've brought up the QI a number of times. And I would imagine, well, I've run into a few of them, to be honest, of people who kind of classify themselves as QIs. But you obviously have quite a bit of experience. Is there some questions that we should be asking as investors to ensure that the QI is, that we vet them out a little bit? What type of questions should we be asking?
That's a great question because you're absolutely right. The only thing that qualifies you for to be a qualified intermediary is that you are disqualified by, or not disqualified by being a related party. So while your attorney cannot be your QI, the car mechanic down the street could be your QI. as long as you haven't taken your car to them for business. So it kind of feels like the wild, wild west. But in fact, most QIs, because of the specificity, if that's a word, that's required in how these things are documented and interpreted, how the client has to be guided, are so deep. Somebody once described me as this nerd that wants to go 2 miles deep in a 2 foot wide creek. And that's what you are when you deal with 1031 exchanges. You're going very deep in a very small part of the tax code. But most people that will go into this are going to be accountants and attorneys who will do nothing but 1031 exchanges. I'm kind of the redheaded stepchild in my firm. I'm the accountant. My partners are all attorneys, but we don't do taxes. We don't do estate tax, estate law, or write wills. We only do 1031 exchanges. So one question is you're going to ask how focused on 1031 exchanges their practice is. Because if they do a few a year, they're not necessarily going to know the deep aspects that are going to be to your benefit. Demonstrated experience by talking to folks who have actually done exchanges with them is huge. There's a certain set of documents that have to be part of every 1031 exchange. We don't really have time to talk through all that, but I forgot to tell you this, Jack, at the beginning, but I actually just wrote a book that's been published. It was a bestseller for like 2 seconds on Amazon, and it's called Lifetime Tax-Free Wealth, The Real Estate Investor's Guide to the 1031 Exchange. And I know you may not have received it yet, but I know my producer sent one to you, so keep checking the mail. But in that book, we talk about specifically ways to vet QIs, because simply hanging out a shingle and saying I'm a qualified to be an intermediary doesn't necessarily mean anything.
No, I appreciate that. It's something that I think everybody needs to be aware of, especially regarding the, because I would imagine the IRS, well, let's just face fact. I mean, it's in a constant state of flux. I would imagine that there has been some recent changes or something on the horizon that people aren't aware of. Do you know of anything right now?
Yeah, there's always cases that are, you know, going back and forth in flux, in particular on some of the exotic types of application of 1031. But the single biggest one that happened in 2018 was when personal property was eliminated from the 1031. And that's still filtering down for people. It used to be that you could exchange real estate for real estate and personal property for personal property, like jet airplanes and mining equipment, restaurant equipment, that kind of stuff. In 2018, the personal property was actually eliminated in favor of cost segregation and bonus depreciation in then President Trump's tax cuts, job creation, whatever the name of that bill was. That's something that carries a lot of significance, because not only does it eliminate when you're trying to sell a business, say, that has real estate and personal property that has to be separated out, but it also opened up the door for people to do what is called a conversion, which can happen later in some, well, anytime really. But as we get later in life, many times we will have, say, 1031 into a vacation rental. So we've got a lot of deferred tax. We have this beautiful rental property that's on the beach in Sarasota, Florida, and I'm ready to retire. Well, because of all the applications of that law, it is now possible to convert that property into your retirement home without triggering tax. And as long as you own that property, you'll never pay the tax. And if any time you sell that property after meeting some conditions, you will get a portion of that deferred tax tax-free. So, oh my gosh, that's like the most amazing opportunity that people don't know about unless you're watching how the law is evolving.
And this is why you would probably want to seek out a qualified QI as well, somebody that knows these nuances. With our economy the way it is there other strategies that we might want to be aware of? I mean, right now there's deals to be had because of the higher interest rates and a few other, this is kind of a buying scenario for some investors. Is there anything there that we should be aware of?
Yeah, you know what? Let's put this into perspective of the four D's of 1031F, 1031 exchanges, the four D's, because each one of them create those opportunities you're talking about. So the first D would be defer, because what we talked about at the very beginning, because you get to immediately start reaping the compounding effect of that deferred tax. It goes into your pocket, not the IRS's. And so whether it's 2 years or 35 years, you get the benefit of it. The second D is also defer, because the 1031 exchange will let you beat the real estate market wherever it's at. And these are the types of opportunities you're talking about. Let's say that you invested in Silicon Valley back in the mid to 2005 to 2010, when it was a little bit depressed, and you rode that wave till everything was so vastly appreciated, and then you sold in 1031 exchanged into this little dusty town called Austin, Texas, following Elon. Well, you went from an area of high appreciation where it had stagnated, and you bought low. So you were probably selling a highly appreciated property and buying several smaller properties. And everybody knows what's happened in Austin. You found a place where the market was still behind and needed to catch up. What a great opportunity to use the 1031 to do that, because you could 1031 from one part of the country to any other part of the country. You could also 1031 from any type of investment real estate into any other type of investment real estate. So if now is the time to move from, well, 4 or 5 years ago was a great time to move from single family into multifamily. Multifamily is pretty competitive now. And the government's talking about doing what? Incentives to first-time home buyers. So maybe it's a great time to move back from commercial or multifamily into single-family homes. And you can 1031 exchange into that. Areas of low appreciation to high cash flow, and high cash flow to areas of high appreciation and low cash flow. Whatever it is you want to do, where the real estate market is, you can use the 1031 to accommodate that. What do you think the third D is?
You'll have to share.
Defer, of course. Because just like the 1031 exchange can accommodate where you are, or I'm sorry, where the real estate market is, it can also accommodate wherever you are in your own personal journey. So when we start out, I don't know if you were like me, but I had far more energy than I had money. So for me, it was all about growth and how I could grow using the least amount of dollars. So we started with single family homes, and we sold one and we bought two. We sold two, we bought four. But then as we got older and we had less time and less energy, we started to consolidate, sell five and buy one. We started to move into passive opportunities. Wherever I was in my energy level and what I was thinking of doing, this is where one of those opportunities we just talked about of converting becomes huge. Because as I get close to retirement, I get 1031 my portfolio and position it close to where I want to live. I can also convert a house into my retirement house. Those are all opportunities within the 1031 exchange. Now, the fourth D, unfortunately, it is not defer. It's die. And it's not my favorite topic either, but it's a very, very important concept, because as long as you are deferring the tax, you're getting the benefit of it. When you die, your heirs inherit your real estate at what is called a stepped-up basis. So they inherit it as if they paid market value on the day you died. So you don't ever have to pay that deferred tax. Your estate never has to pay that deferred tax. Your heirs don't have to pay that deferred tax. In fact, all of that tax disappears. And that's how people build legacy wealth for their children. You defer to start it on. You defer wherever the market's at. You defer wherever your life cycle's at. And then you die, and you will have given your heirs an incredible gift of real estate wealth that's tax-free. So are there opportunities with there? Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, that's a definitely an important aspect to point out. You did mention passive. Could you talk a little bit about how that would work? Let's say somebody wants to work. I think that's everybody's real estate dream, is to eventually work towards a passive state. Can you 1031 exchange into a REIT, for example, or some sort of other vehicle?
Yeah, of course. Passive is a relative term, right? As long as you're investing, it's never passive, even if it's stocks. So, but it's a question of going to as passive as you can get. Now, REITs do not qualify because a REIT is not real estate. A REIT is a company that owns real estate. And that's the nuance. You can only 1031 into actual real estate. So you could 1031 into an apartment building that you own, but you could not 1031 into a REIT that owns that apartment building.
How about a syndication?
I'm sorry,
How about a syndication?
Syndications. Sometimes, every so often, a syndication will allow you to take title to a tenant in common percentage of the real estate. So you actually go on deed as a tenant in common. But most often, I'd say 95% of the time, syndications are set up so it's the same thing as a REIT. You're not actually buying real estate. You're buying a membership interest in an entity that owns real estate. And so that has to qualify for a 1031 exchange. The most common example, two examples of truly passive, are going to be triple net commercial properties, where it's always large national companies buying them that are leasing your property, and the tenant, whether it's Arby's or Safe Light Glass, are paying all of the taxes, insurance, and maintenance. That's the three ends of triple net. So all you're doing is managing a 20 to 25 year lease. That's pretty passive. Of course, you still have to renew the lease, et cetera, et cetera. But that's one really passive opportunity. The other one is what's called a Delaware statutory trust. Now, these are like syndications because the Delaware statutory trust is a entity that owns real estate, and it sells to you a percentage of that entity. So you wouldn't think that it qualifies. But back in 2004, the IRS decided that it did. So they specifically blessed Delaware statutory trusts as real estate for purposes of 1031 replacement. Now, you do absolutely nothing with these. Just like a syndicator, the syndicator owns it, buys it, manages it, takes care of it, and sells it. You're along for the ride. But because it's in that specific form, it qualifies. And that's generally the most common end game, because it generates cash flow with no active effort.
Well, Dave, this has been a fantastic conversation, and I appreciate you kind of going into the weeds on some of this as we try to unravel. One more time, the 1031investor.com, and that's going to be a clickable link in the show notes. I'll also include a link to Dave's book on Amazon, so you can get a hold of that easily. So again, check out the show notes for those. But Dave, I hope we can transition into the rapid fire questions as we close out this episode.
You had me on pins and needles the entire show.
But before we do that, is there a question or concept that you wish we would have covered associated with the 1031 exchange?
You know, I believe it or not, we covered a lot of ground in a short amount of time, didn't we?
Yeah, we sure did.
I would say that the best thing that you could do to take advantage of this, start earlier with planning rather than later. Although the mechanics of a 1031 start with the closing of your sale, plan way before that to shape your direction, and it'll be that much more smoother. And can I also ask blatantly for a boomer question? I never thought I'd be able to say this, but we too have a YouTube channel, that you can locate off of our website at the 1031 Investor. Give us a thumbs up and a subscribe. I wanted to say that all my life.
Absolutely. Make sure you have that. And I'll try to have that link in the show notes as well. Well, Dave, if you're ready, we'll hit some of these rapid fire questions.
All right, let's go for it.
What lie do real estate investors tell themselves and sometimes to others?
It's rented below market value.
Boy, I have bought more properties with that as the first thing they say out of their mouth than anything else.
Isn't that hilarious? Yeah.
Do you have a book recommendation or what are you reading right now?
I'm actually reading with my son and a couple of his friends right now because we're trying to pass on financial literacy to the next generation. One of the most awesome books on inflation, and it's called Whatever Happened to Penny Candy. And I mean, you'll have to Google it up. It's part of a series of books from the Uncle Charlie series, and it's written like at high school level. So it's perfect for me to struggle with, but it's the best primer on truly inflation, how it works and what it does to our economy.
That's a great book. I might have to do that with my kids. That'd be right up their alley. If you could go back in time and give your younger self one piece of advice, what would that be?
Be more patient. Be more patient. You know, everybody that jumped into real estate in 2012 is starting to feel panicked because around them are all the voices saying it's a changing world. It'll never be the same. And my younger self now has gone through about five or six of those same periods where it was never going to be the same. And guess what? It's always the same. And if you're patient at the end of a real estate market, you will have plenty of firepower left when it comes back again. So right. Yeah, that's what I tell myself.
Now, this one is a bit more of your business-oriented question. What single strategy, process, or tool have you implemented to have the most time-saving impact to your business?
You know, it's a silly little thing, but it's built in templates. I mean, we've got staff, we have people answering phones, we've got people doing paperwork. Every time anyone touches, well, it's all virtual paper now, right? Anytime anybody touches a computer, as much as we can, there are templates that take two or three keystrokes, as opposed to having to type the same five paragraphs.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably been the biggest change since sliced bread for me.
Yeah. You know, that's a great, I use those all the time. And in fact, I don't know if you're on a Mac, but there's a tool called Raycast and Alfred, and a text expander is another one where, you know, with a couple keystrokes, you can just create these snippets that you can just reuse over and over again.
I just wrote that down, Raycast and Alfred, because I have a Mac and I didn't know about those. That's awesome.
Raycast is a free tool. Like, you can upgrade it, of course. They've built in some AI stuff, of course, that requires a subscription, but the core functionality is free to use. Well, Dave, this has been fantastic. I really appreciate your time and giving us these insights around 1031 exchange. Again, it is the1031investor.com. Again, it's going to be a clickable link in the show notes, but I hope you'll consider coming back again so we can dive into something even deeper next time.
Have you learned at least one actionable step to incorporate into your real estate investing? If so, please consider returning some of that value by leaving a positive review, subscribing to our YouTube channel, or joining our growing network on Facebook and Twitter. You can find links to all of our social media accounts in the show notes. See you next time.